Then we compare.
Yes. First of all, I want to thank Ilya for inviting me, and...
Ирина, выключите, пожалуйста, микрофоны там тоже, потому что фамилия плохо слышно.
Okay. I don't usually apologize for anything, but I'm going to make a couple of apologies at the outset. First is that I have a head cold, and so that I wasn't planning, but I think that the talk will go fine. But the second thing is that I hadn't quite realized that everyone was going to be talking about Boris Hessen here. I don't plan to talk about Boris Hessen, but I do plan to talk about something that was that's been flagged in the program, and that's kind of the logic of revolutionary change. And I want to talk about this in the context of the work that I've been doing now most recently. And in fact, the sorts of things that I'll be saying is drawn from an article that will be appearing in the Journal of Post-Human Studies, which is a new journal. Just first issue's already come out. And I think you'll see in the course of my talk why the piece is being published there. But it may not be apparent in the beginning, okay? So bear with me a little bit why the piece is coming out there. The first thing I want to say is that the way in which I approach this topic, because I've been very intrigued by this idea of whether there is a logic to revolutionary change, and the intuition that I want to start with is one that I mentioned in the abstract, which has to do with what Thomas Kuhn called the Orwellian character of the history of science as written by scientists. Not as written by historians, but as written by scientists. And so what he has in mind is this part of Orwell's 1984, basically describing the activities of the Ministry of Truth. And the Ministry of Truth is basically about rewriting newspapers so that whatever happens to be the government's current policy, right, the entire past looks like it's always led to it. So the government is always being presented as operating in a completely coherent and consistent fashion. And the main character, Winston Smith, is in this business. This is what he does for a living. And it causes him a kind of crisis of confidence, you might say, in the regime. And that's what the book 1984 is basically about. Now, I always thought this was a very profound kind of point with regard to Kuhn. And in a way, you can sort of look at this in isolation, independently of whatever else you want to say about the rest of his theory. In fact, for me, it's probably the most influential part. And what I want to focus on is this idea that in some sense you have to revise the past in order to move into the future. Right? This is the kind of idea. And so in this paper that I've written, right, I talk a lot about revisionism. Revisionism, it seems to me, is very much part of this kind of idea of revolutionary change. And what is going on with revisionism? Well, basically what you're doing, especially if you do it in this kind of Orwellian way, is in a sense you're reinterpreting and reviving certain aspects of the past so that in fact they either become more or less influential than they had been up to this point. Right, so in a sense, you tell the history differently. So rather than imagining, okay, we can all agree on how the past has been, and now we're going to do this. Rather, you imagine that there are actually quite a lot of different possible pasts out there, and what you do when you're revising is, in a sense, coming up with an alternative past that then justifies where you want to go in the future.
May I ask
you? Sure.
In the context of science, right? Actually, there are two things. One thing is just rewriting science, right? There is, I don't know, elementary science, like in textbook, we no longer, you know, learn it like in Newton times fair body, but we rewrite it. But we're rewriting it, that theory, we are not rewriting Andrew. History, right?
Andrew.
So is this...
You will act... Okay, Well, it's a fair question. No, I'll answer. I mean, if you don't mind, it's a fair question.
Let's go with questions a little bit later.
Okay, no, but let me just take care of this now, okay, just right now. No, it's a fair point, because what do I mean when I'm saying rewriting the past exactly, okay? I'm talking about the causal significance that's ascribed to things, okay? So in other words, it's not that you, I mean, it's an interesting point, right? It's not that you say Newton never existed, let's say, if you had a kind of revisionist physics. No, you do what actually happened when Einstein did the revolution in physics, which is that the significance of Newton becomes contained, right? So Newton becomes a historical figure, you might say, for the first time, and is no longer someone you bring into the contemporary world. He's seen as part of the past, but not the present and future. That's a very radical move. It says something about the causal significance of the person involved. It doesn't say he never existed, but it contains the causal significance that he has, right? And of course, you could even go further, and this often happens when you have revolutions, both in politics and in science, is that people are effectively, or you might say officially, forgotten, which is to say they no longer even figure in the causal lineage. It's not that they didn't exist, they still exist, you can find their, you know, you can find where they're buried, you can find their books, but they have no clear causal relationship with the way in which the world is going at the moment. So they're seen as kind of interesting curiosities, right? You know, sort of the people who history left behind. Right? And so there's also that as well, and that's part of what I talk about in the paper too. So what we're talking about here is kind of the change in the causal significance of the past. Okay? That's kind of to put it, you see what I'm saying? So I'm not saying that Newton disappears and never has existed, but in a sense, if you don't say that Newton is very important, you know, if you contain the importance, you have actually done something quite significant, it seems to me. Right? You have done something quite, and of course, people could go further. And of course, one of the things that happened, let's stick with the Einstein revolution thing, because I actually talk about that in the paper, and I was going to bring it up later in this talk. One of the things that happened as a result of the Einstein revolution was that certain people who had been seen as merely philosophers all of a sudden become precursors of this scientific revolution. So I have in mind people like Leibniz and, of course, Ernst Mach. Okay, so these are people who, from the Newtonian standpoint, are seen as kind of cranks. You know, people who came up with objections that, in a sense, maybe at some philosophical, theoretical level are objections, but didn't really do much to change the course of the Newtonian science. That kept on going along. But then once Einstein challenges fundamental assumptions of Newton with regard to absolute space and time, right, then guys like Leibniz and Mach, who are talking about a relational theory of space and time, all of a sudden seem to have been the precursors of this. And so their status changes, right? So this is the kind of thing I'm talking about here, okay? So in a sense, otherwise these guys would just be seen as mere philosophers, maybe interesting to read, but not of scientific relevance. And that changed. You see, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And so the question is, you know, how does this happen? And to what extent does the underlying, what should we say, metaphysics of this, about what kind of conception of time do you need to have, how does that change the way we normally think about history, right? And especially the nature of historical change, both in politics and in science. And this is kind of what I'm working on here, because I think that these two movements that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about, transhumanism and posthumanism, are actually movements that in a way are engaged in a very substantial revisionism with regard to the history of the human, okay? Maybe I should just get directly to this because since you've got me on this track, this might be easier, and then I might be able to backtrack with some other stuff afterwards. Here's the thing, when we talk about humanism in the modern Enlightenment sense, which transhumanism and posthumanism are normally seen as challenging, we're basically, the object of that study is Homo sapiens, okay? And I say that quite explicitly, because what we're talking about here is an entity that can be tracked biologically as a species over time, right? To the, you know, and now we believe that there is an evolutionary narrative from that, of which this species is an offshoot, and we can tell that kind of story. And that's the story of the history of humanity. In a sense, that's a substratum of the story, of modern Enlightenment humanism. not necessarily Renaissance humanism, and this is a very important point, that the moment that Homo sapiens became the grounding notion of the human was largely due to Linnaeus. Carolus Linnaeus, who actually coins this name for us as a species, 1752, okay? And it's after that that you start to get the kinds of issues about what does it mean to be human in the modern sense beginning. In other words, how are we different from apes, right? That's always kind of the way it gets put in the beginning. When you want to say, how are human beings different, it's how they're different from apes. This was not necessarily the way of framing the issue prior to the invention of Homo sapiens. So if you look at, say, Renaissance humanism, okay? Renaissance humanism is not fixated on the image of the ape, okay? I mean, for the Renaissance humanists, right, the human is basically the material embodiment of the logos, right? So they've still got a kind of Christian thing going on in the background where the fact that we're created in the image and likeness of God, right, is in a sense the starting point. And so this means that in principle, the human could radically change its body, abandon its body. Perhaps there might be humans in other planets, right? So the Renaissance is the great period of the sort of, is there life on other planets, multiple worlds? You remember people like Bruno and Leibniz, and all these people are on this idea and presupposes nothing that the human is tied to the ape, right? The human is something else. The human is this kind of logos bearer, right? And it could be moving outward into space. And this is the way the Renaissance people were talking about it. And if you look at people like Leonardo da Vinci, who are, you know, they're very fascinated by flying and taking off and all this, it's because their conception of the human is not an earthbound ape when it got right down to it. And so if you have those guys to tell the history of the human back in the Renaissance, they're not going to tell a story about apes, you know, becoming walking on two legs. That's not going to be their story, but that's our story. And my point is that transhumanism and posthumanism, in rather different ways, are challenging this, right? In a sense, they're relocating the human somewhere else. And that makes it kind of interesting, and it makes it kind of difficult to assimilate, because so much of our understanding of the human, however much we have been revising it over the past, whatever, 250, 300 years, has basically kept to the Homo sapiens kind of core. Okay, so that even somebody, I'll give you an example where I think this is very strong. You take somebody who in very many respects is not a naturalist or materialist or biologist in any sense at all. And I mean Noam Chomsky. Okay, now Noam Chomsky, right, he nevertheless thinks that there's a special organ in the human being. He calls it the language organ. He thinks there's something that could be biologically identified that distinguishes humans from other animals, and specifically apes. So he believes there is a kind of essence there to be found in the biology. Now you see, what's going on with him, I would say, is a kind of, as we say sometimes, you know, a kind of syncretism. Right, where in a sense he still has some version of this divine logos idea going on, which is being conveyed through language. But at the same time, he feels it has to be planted somewhere in the material organ of Homo sapiens. And that's a very ill fit. They don't fit very well together, okay? Because the Homo sapiens story, you know, is one where it's not clear, other than the material body, what it is that distinguishes the human, right? Everything else is kind of left up for grabs. So we've got this very kind of strange situation here where, in a sense, we're entering into a period where the nature of the human is changing. And my point would be that if you change what the story of humanity is about, then you're changing not only where we can go in the future, which is what transhumanism and posthumanism is mostly about, but you're also changing something about where we came from, okay? And where did we actually descend from, okay? So to give you an example of this, if you say that human beings may someday merge with machines, may become technologically enhanced, may even upload their consciousness, the most important parts of being human, into a silicon form and continue in that way. If you say all that, then you have to explain, well, why have we been apes for so long, for so many billions of years, right? Why suddenly do we have this takeoff point? Well, if we actually lived in a world where people believed in transhumanism, then this wouldn't be so mysterious, because you wouldn't be telling the story as the story of an ape who all of a sudden decided not to be an ape. Rather, you would be telling something about, let's say, the channeling of some kind of universal intelligence, which for a while was embodied in Homo sapiens, perhaps, but then moved in many different directions as it reached, let's say, a certain measure of self-consciousness. You'd be telling a different kind of history, in which then the ape-like nature of the human actually performs only a very specific temporary role, but isn't seen as part of the essence of who human beings are. Okay? So this is kind of what I'm getting at here, that there's a sense in which, as we think about doing histories that are useful for the future, which is kind of what Orwell was going on about, right? In a kind of sarcastic, satirical way. He was talking about a government that was basically constantly coming up with a history that was serviceable to the future they were moving in, and doing this on a regular basis. Then it seems to me that there are some very interesting open questions that are made available. Because if we are going to be moving into certain kinds of radical futures, then we need to have a history that's suitable to it. Right? Because if you don't have a history that's suitable to it, then that radical future is going to look scary, irrational, problematic, because it looks like such a sharp break with the past. Right? I mean, and that's how I think a lot of this transhumanist stuff looks now, because you're sort of imagining we're going to keep the history that we've sort of arisen from Homo sapiens, and then all of a sudden, at some point in the early 21st century, we suddenly decided not to be that. Whereas if we actually did live in a transhumanist world, we wouldn't be telling that initial history. We would be telling a different history where the fact that we are Homo sapiens would play a relatively smaller role. It wouldn't be forgotten, it wouldn't be neglected, there'd probably be some Homo sapiens still out there, but the point is it wouldn't have the causal significance that it currently does with regard to grounding our intuitions about what it means to be human. Okay? I mean, I hope this is clear to you, that there's a sense in which, because we're living in a time now, right, where people are imagining all kinds of radical futures in different ways, okay? And one of the reasons why they seem either implausible or frightening is because we are still sticking with the same story about the past. We are still imagining, we have a kind of common understanding of the past, and so and if we have that common understanding, then it's quite natural to think we'll just sort of carry on in a sense that way. So human beings will remain as Homo sapiens. They may continue to live longer, but they won't live to 200 years, let alone 1,000 years or anything like that. We'll sort of carry on in this kind of narrative. But in order to properly imagine these kinds of radical futures, you actually need to have a radical reconception of the past that makes it rational. Okay? And this is where I think there's going to be a lot of contested space in the future. I mean, there already is to a certain extent, but I think this is even going to be more so. And in this regard, I think the way we need to think about time here, and this is where I want to get back into the history and philosophy of science a little bit, because I do think there's something quite interesting about the way in which Kuhn and Popper, who in both of their ways, I think, understood what I'm talking about here, how they contextualize it, because they contextualize it quite differently in terms of their historical understanding. And here I want to draw a distinction from the Greek, which is very much, which is actually used by, we can go into this if you want, theologians when they're interpreting the Bible, but we don't need to talk about this, Chronos and Kairos. Okay? And so Chronos is the idea of time as temporal, as something that's passing like a stream, and there's a certain kind of pattern to it, and that's how you think about time. Now, this pattern may be linear, it may be cyclical, but it's patterned, basically. Okay, and Kuhn's view of science fits into this very well, basically a cyclical view of science in a kind of Chronos model where there are stages and so forth through which one goes. But the alternative way of looking at history is Kairos. And Kairos is about, what the way it gets put, is that it's the ecstatic moment, right? The moment that changes everything, right? Where the future is different and the past is different, right? You are in a different world. In a sense, this is the kind of thing that Kuhn is trying to get at when he talks about a gestalt switch. Mm-hmm. Right? This is kind of what Kuhn's talking about when he talks about a gestalt switch. But I think, generally speaking, somebody like Popper believed that this is kind of what could happen if you do a crucial experiment in science, right, which ends up forcing you to reconsider your fundamental assumptions. Right? So in other words, the whole point of a crucial experiment is that you're proved wrong, right? That's the idea. The options are clear and you get proved wrong, and that's when you get maximum benefit from an epistemic standpoint for Popper. Why? Because what that does is it forces you to think about your fundamental assumptions, and you realize that at least some of the things you had been thinking were wrong, and you need new assumptions, okay? So you get new founding principles. This is a bit like saying you have to rethink your past, okay, in terms of how you go forward. And I think this is one reason why somebody like Popper, for example, when he talks about science, doesn't feel the need to come up with a narrative of science. Right? Kuhn is giving you a kind of narrative account, chronos-based account of science. Popper doesn't give you a narrative account of science because science isn't in the narrative. Science is in the act, in the kairotic act of the crucial experiments. And they could happen anytime, right? And they could be done by anyone, right? This is and when Popper is in his famous debate with Kuhn, right, in London in 1965, right, he talks about that science is about permanent revolution. This is Popper's term, okay? And this is what he's talking about, right? It's about what the attitude toward history should be, what the attitude toward time should be, right? And that you're not just following a narrative, but rather you are creating the moment in which a new narrative can be born. Okay? And I think this is much more in the spirit. And if you look at the people who followed Popper, Lakatos, Feyerabend, you see that sentiment, I think, very much there, right? And this is the kind of view that I'm pushing as well, okay? And I think it's this kind of notion of time that we need to really take seriously, especially given that we're entering into a period where people are projecting multiple narratives for the future, and I think everyone agrees it's fairly, quote, radical revolutionary at many different dimensions. Now, I will close here by just mentioning one background source that in a way has stimulated, focused my thinking in this direction. And this is might seem very weird, so I'm not gonna explain it here, people, but I do recommend you have a look at this if you're really interested. Are any of you familiar with Alexander Wendt? He's a German-born American international relations theorist, okay? And he published a book 2 years ago, which I've reviewed and I think is very, very interesting, called Quantum Mind and Social Science, okay? And so the kind of notion of time we're talking about and causation and all this kind of stuff associated with the kairotic thing is in a way about is a quantum conception. In the sense that if you imagine what is an event in quantum mechanics, right, it's the collapse of the wave function, which is to say lots of different possibilities get brought into one moment, okay? And he uses this idea and develops it actually going through a lot of the quantum mechanics to come up with a rather alternative understanding about how we should understand history and social science more generally. And I'm not here to defend everything he says in that book, but nevertheless, it seems to me what he is trying to get at is this kind of idea that I'm talking about with regard to the need for a kind of revised conception of time if we're really going to be able to deal properly with ideas of radicalism and revolution without finding them too scary. Because I think, in a sense, that is the main obstacle. They seem scary, they seem implausible, they seem beyond the pale, but that may be just because we have a rather restricted view of what the past has been that ends up then foregrounding what we think the future can be. So I will stop here and take some questions. Is that okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah?
Andrei, another question.
Yes, a question about history. Uh-huh. I think that there is probably some ambiguity, or maybe it's at least I see two things. When we talk about revision of past, there are two different senses in my view of revision. One thing that actually, when you responded my question already, you said, okay, there are certain things that we somehow take for granted, right? For example,
Right.
Or do we think they are different, or you deliberately kind of confuse them and saying there is no historical fact and history it's all about, you know, just single thing. So we cannot really divide facts and say interpretations of facts. And,
I think analytically they're different, but I do think that in practice they can blend together. So for example, because one of the things that there's a book that I cite in the paper by Louis Feuer, I don't know if you're familiar with him, called Einstein and the Generations of Science. It came out in the 1970s. And it's basically about what Einstein and the quantum, early quantum guys, what they read as students, which in a sense kind of turned them on to their views. And very often it was the people who their professors thought were cranks, right? So it would be guys like Mach, for example, who was pretty much a kind of outsider to the physics establishment and got into all kinds of controversies, and his students never got jobs, and it was really, but he was a very public figure. He was a very public figure. And the point is that, when Einstein was coming up with this theory of relativity, which was based on a reinterpretation of an experiment, right? This is why Popper likes Einstein so much. He was thinking about precedents for how to alternatively think about it, because it seemed that a fundamental assumption of Newtonian mechanics is being challenged, and so where do you go to think about a radically alternative way of thinking about physics? Well, you could go to these people who were seen as way beyond the pale because they didn't feed into the current paradigm, and this would be Leibniz and Mach and people like that. And so that, in a sense, you know, from the biographical standpoint, right, this is what Einstein did, essentially. He found inspiration in those guys to give him an alternative framework for making sense of this anomalous phenomenon in the laboratory. But then once that happened, okay, so once Einstein's revolution gets off the ground and people are rewriting the physics books, right, then interest gets developed in looking at Leibniz and Mach and a lot of these other people in a different way, right? And in a sense, looking at them, you know, reinterpreting what they were doing, perhaps being more generous, more charitable, you know, and so errors that would have dismissed them in terms of the normal way of doing things suddenly become something that isn't so problematic, right? A lot of this kind of rewriting does start to happen. So that motivates then historians and others, right, to kind of rethink what was actually going on in the past. Okay, and so even if those people aren't officially trying to justify the new order, nevertheless, you know, they're in a sense contributing to it too. But does that answer your question?
No, but I still think that, we talked about Leibniz, it's a very good case because exactly, I think in the early 20th century, it would be interesting actually to compare with Einstein's work, but almost the same time, a big portion of new, part of archivals.
Yes.
Then recently. Yeah, so, right, so I think it's right to say it's somehow prompted the historical study, but still I believe that something like historical facts, you know, somehow underlying historical truth, is not really challenged by this.
You might be right, okay?
Yeah.
But I think the issue is whether that's such an important thing, because to me, the facts are less important than the causal significance assigned to them. Okay, so you can admit, so you don't have to erase the historical record in some sense if you want to change, you know, the past. No, you just have to say that what was said at that time is not as important, not as significant, doesn't quite mean what you think it is, but you still have the piece of paper in the archives. You've not destroyed it. But what you've done is you've radically altered its causal significance. I mean, you can do that in a lot of different ways. And the fact, you're right, remains the same, right? The fact remains the same, but the causal significance has been radically revised. And that's the point I want to drive home here. So, this is not about, you know, destroying archives or rewriting in some literal sense, forging documents and things. It's not about that. It's about the causal significance assigned to it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
like to ask you a comment on the revisionism in philosophy of history of science.
Yeah.
I mean, the central phenomenon for us is the scientific revolution of the 17th century. And as you should know, some historians question the very notion of the scientific revolution. For example, the major book by Floris Coyne.
Yes. Who claimed many books now by him.
Yeah. Yes. No, I mean, Philo's book about where he claimed that he find a final solution to the problem.
Yes, yes.
And is in fact dismissed the very idea.
Yes.
And here we have a great discrepancy when Einstein and Feynman, for example, great physicists, are quite clear that Galileo was the father of modern science, regardless of the popular science language. Mm-hmm. Language and historian like Floris Coyne refuted by explaining who is the revisionist here and what is your view?
Okay, well, first of all, revisionism is always happening. So the establishment was once revisionist. So I mean, the scientific revolution is a very interesting example because I do think. If you look at what purpose because I'm someone who still talks about the scientific revolution in the singular, but that's very closely connected to my conception of science, okay? So the two things are not disconnected. I think the scientific revolution was basically a kind of a moment that was kind of written into history, you might say, in order to establish a kind of orderly transition from Christian theology to some kind of modern Enlightenment worldview, both of which are said to be concerned with, you know, universal issues of humanity and nature and so forth. And so the scientific revolution, given the way it's constituted, because it's usually presented as having a strong theological background, right? So disagreeing with the church establishment, but not disagreeing with the kind of larger metaphysical concerns of theology, and then bringing and basically turning it into a kind of more materialistic framework, pursuing the same ideas. Now, I think that is very much the self-understanding of science that you have in the modern era, and it suits guys like Einstein and all the rest of them very well. I think the reason why you're finding now people like Cohen and also Steve Shapin, you know, a lot of people now are saying there was no single scientific revolution, right? There were all these different things going on and all the rest of it, is because that kind of vision of science is disappearing, right? That kind of unified, universalist notion of science that was grounded by the 17th century idea of a scientific revolution is disappearing. And so now historians, in a way, are kind of emboldened, you might say, to kind of knock the myth down, because in a way it's become a myth in this kind of relatively negative sense, right? It doesn't quite match any longer the self-understanding of scientists who are increasingly faced with the limitations of what they're doing, the fact that they're doing many different things, the fact that there's a public that's very concerned about what they're doing and they don't think they're necessarily doing the right thing, right? All of these things, I think, contribute to a kind of changed self-understanding of science that then opens the door to saying this scientific revolution thing didn't happen. But I see the two things as connected, right? It's connected to the fact that we seem to be in the process of moving into a different future with regard to our understanding of science, and so therefore we are beginning to rewrite the history so that the scientific revolution is seen as some kind of historical mistake, as a historiographical mistake. Right, that in a sense, we shouldn't have even had the idea, right? If we really want to understand what took place in the past of science. So that's what I see. So I see guys like Cohen and Shapin as engaged in a kind of historiographical revisionism to suit the time in which we live, where that unified vision of science is disappearing. That's what I would say.
Switch on, please.
All this post-human technology becoming transhuman. I want to just to be sure that I understood you correctly while saying about your division between Chronos and Kairos on the connection between Popper and Kuhn on the other hand. Is Popper stays with Kronos while...
No, Kairos. Kairos. No, the other way around.
Kuhn is with Kronos.
Yes, because Kuhn has a narrative account of science. And so his notion of the revolutionary moment is embedded as a stage in a cyclical narrative, right? So in a way, he domesticates it. He domesticates the revolutionary moment, whereas Popper has the revolutionary moment as a naked transformative moment. And that's why it could happen anytime, be done by anyone, and that's why he liked to associate himself with the phrase permanent revolution. He thinks science should be in a permanent revolution.
Well, exactly. The term impressed me because I didn't expect somebody as conservative as Popper.
He's not conservative. He's liberal. Liberal's different. He's not socialist, but he's liberal. Okay, well, that's an important point here.
I shouldn't label him himself. But the term permanent revolution wasn't invented by him.
No, I know that, of course.
Well, no. And in the way that you try to reassure us saying that permanent revolutions are less frightening than definite revolutions doesn't help it.
No, I'm not saying that. That's not where the less... No. I think the less frightening, what makes it less frightening is if you see how you prepare the way for this, okay? So what I was just talking about now in response to a question from him, right? I think we are undergoing a major transformation with regard to science that will make the 17th century notion of a scientific revolution perhaps obsolete because it doesn't any longer match to our conception of science. It's no longer the history of the science that we believe in, okay? Now, if I put that to you as a proposition directly, that seems very radical and scary. And say, what are you talking about, you know? But in fact, if you actually look at the historical work going on and the way people are talking, you see the shifts already happening. And there will come a point in the future where people will just take for granted. Of course there was no scientific revolution. That was just something cooked up by Coiré and Butterfield in the 1930s and 40s, right? And that was because they had this, you know, thing going on about preserving science and all the rest of it. But it doesn't really exist. That's not really what science is. Right, we will, you know, my guess is we will come to a point where that will be taken for granted. We're not there yet, but we're moving in that direction. And what you will be able to say in retrospect then is that there was a radical change in our understanding of science. That we used to believe there was a scientific revolution, that this was a defining moment in the history of science, and now we no longer believe that. You see, so the radicalism will be seen in retrospect. This is the thing. That's what I think normally happens. Keep on going. I'm fine.
I also have a question on this post-humanism thing.
Okay.
First of all, Frank, I don't quite understand. You could just explain
sure.
the whole notion somehow, because that very question, what is human, I think for me at least it sounds a bit like kind of essentialism, right? Why such a thing as the human should exist at all? I mean, what is like platonic entity or what? Or is it more about kind of, you refer to we, right? You said we, and
okay.
Then, yeah, what kind of...
Okay, I think the most straightforward way to think about this, and this, because in a sense what I've been saying about science is a bit like what I would say about the human, where we're talking about the subject of a narrative. Right, the subject of a narrative. What is this story about? What is it? So we have this account of what it is to be a human, right? What is the thing that we're talking about? That
why we cannot diversify the story, just saying, okay, we are talking about Homo sapiens, right? We have such you know, interesting feature and study. Then of course we may now much better really study real history of fact, and here we have much more access than.
Okay,
and making some project for future.
Right? Yeah, I know, I understand. I guess part of what's implicit in my argument, and this is why the issue about the relation between history and science is important, is there's a normative dimension to this, right? So in other words, of course, we could, as philosophers, come up with 13 different definitions of the human,
yeah.
Right? But it turns out that certain ones, or maybe even one particular one, has quite a lot of salience in terms of things like human rights, right? When human gets implicated in various discussions, right? Just like when scientific gets implicated in various discussions, right? There are many sciences, but there's a sense in which there's some kind of grounding notion, right, that's there, especially when we're talking about normative contexts, okay? And my point is that what it has been this idea of Homo sapiens, okay? And I think one of the ways you see this is that even when we do history as the subject and we want to talk about where does history begin, it's still controversial to actually say human history begins pre-Homo sapiens. Even though, obviously, if you believe in the Homo sapiens view now, you have to believe we have to descend from somewhere, right? But most historians, right, when they're doing history, and this is why it's still a humanities subject, right, they're basically starting typically from the period of artifacts and and writing, right? I mean, that's what history is about. It's about the creature who does that. You see? I mean, and so there's a lot of us, you know, that's the kind of thing I'm saying is being challenged. Right, the idea that it's this upright ape, but an upright ape that in some sense is still separated from the rest of the animal kingdom, which is what Linnaeus had, right? Linnaeus had both. He had the idea that we were related to the apes, but he still believed because we had a soul or a mind or a consciousness, we were still radically distinct. And I still think that is the anchor point for discussions of the human today, certainly in the human sciences. That's what I would say.
My question deals with this Kuhn-Popper controversy, which is, I think, is far from being correctly understood till now, because of that fact that there were persons that they hardly understood each other while discussing the same thing, apparently. So the development of science, the nature of scientific knowledge, and so forth. And it has direct connection with the question of the historical causality, because if we take the picture of knowledge, scientific knowledge given by Kuhn, and comparing this picture with the same, with that picture of scientific knowledge given by Popper, then we should see, perhaps, that the accent given by Kuhn is more descriptive than normative accent given by Popper. Namely, the idea of Kuhn as a historian of science was to show the correct picture of how science evolves. Science evolves through the long periods of stability, interrupted sometimes, very rarely, interrupted by a periods who could hardly describe. He spoke about the fact that the revolutions are invisible. And still, his book is entitled The Structure of Scientific Revolution. There's a paradox. There is no structure of scientific revolution. Nobody can see it. I can describe it in a proper sense. What is describable is these long periods covered by paradigm. This can be described.
Yeah.
But we should understand that this allegedly descriptive picture has a very strong normative content.
Exactly.
Yes. This prescribes scientists how to behave. Please don't be inspired by the revolutions. Don't provide revolutions. It's senseless because we cannot understand what it is. The main thing for the science is to do his daily work. To make experiments, small explanations, the tactic of small steps, borrowed from Popper. And now we see Popper, who proclaimed the technique the technology not of small steps, but very decisive steps. Every step is a revolution. But this revolution is also invisible, because if every step is a revolution, there is no revolution at all. Everything is revolution and nothing is revolution. So Popper's idea is much more normative.
Yeah.
He would like to inspire philosophers to be bold thinkers, not scientists.
It's not. I don't think actually Popper sees a difference between scientists and philosophers.
Both spoke about different things. Kuhn speaks about science, Popper about philosophy.
Because he doesn't need, because
doing philosophy, talking about science.
Yes, that's right. Right.
And
I mean,
we should be very, very cautious. How to say it? Accurate, according to Kuhn, speaking about science, we shouldn't be philosophers, I should say. We should be much more historians, and we should carefully describe what is going on. And hypotheses don't finger, like Newton said. In this sense, I don't understand the difference between them.
They're very different. I think you've actually explained how they're different. I mean,
in regard to science.
Oh, I think no. I think you actually have got it right.
Just a moment.
They're different.
Would science be revolutionary? Popper would say that you should do you must do revolution in every step. Science is inert, according to Popper. And he would like to revolutionize this inert science, Kuhnian science. He is not he don't like this picture of inert science. He would like normatively to change this picture.
Yeah.
But the factual picture is the same in Kuhn and in Popper.
Well, I think if you're talking about their understanding of the history of science, I think basically that's true.
And about the causal relation, what causal implication can we draw from the Kuhnian picture of science and philosophy in science or about science, and Popperian picture of science and or with philosophy?
Okay.
I think it is practically the same.
Now, you've already, actually, they're different, and you've actually indicated how they're different, and you've made some interesting remarks that I want to flag because they're sort of subtle. The last point, I think, while it is true that Kuhn and Popper have roughly speaking the same understanding of the history of science, and certainly were focused on roughly the same aspect of the history of science, namely the history of physics, right? That's pretty much what, you know, including astronomy and so forth. That's basically both of them were talking about that the most. Even though Popper himself was trained in experimental psychology, he doesn't actually refer to the history of that field very much in his writings, though you see evidence of it in his thinking. But not in terms of when he talks about history of science, it's history of physics. So Kuhn and Popper are similar in this regard. The difference is, though, that Kuhn's narrative works, you might say, because of the way physics is institutionalized, okay? The creation of the paradigm. So in other words, whereas Popper is focusing on, let's say, the experiment that changes everything, Kuhn is focused more on how does this change get institutionalized so that it's seen as normal, right? And this is where the revolutions become invisible, right? Because Popper is saying, look, you know, it was Galileo's experiments that did this. It was Einstein that did this, right? This is what revolutionized stuff. And Kuhn says, well, you know, only in some literal sense, but in the sense that's relevant to science, it's the institutionalization of the revolution. It's the normalizing of the result. which is, and you know, and that begins then this Orwellian process of rewriting. Okay, so that there's a difference there. The point, you know, a business about Popper. Popper did not really see. I mean, the reason why I think Popper, I mean, you know, Popper is very interesting because I don't actually think Popper really believed there was a clear line to be drawn between philosophers and scientists. And whereas Kuhn did. Kuhn, in fact, believed that philosophers were troublemakers and that scientists were professionals. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Kuhn has a very clear kind of sociological, what we would call a sociological understanding of the difference between philosophers and scientists. Each have got their own roles, you know, good fences make good neighbors, this kind of thing. Whereas Popper is, in a way, harking back to kind of a natural philosophy tradition, you might say, which even people like Maxwell and Einstein occasionally, even Heisenberg, these people are still making reference to that in terms of, you know, justifying their ways of thinking. Where in a sense, what a natural philosopher does is kind of do the same thing a philosopher does, but uses experiments to do them. Right, so the hypotheses which would otherwise be metaphysical doctrines that are undecidable, all of a sudden get brought down to the level of experiment where you have two options, either one or the other, and then nature decides. Right, the kind of Baconian approach, and so Popper was, you know, that was the difference. That was the difference between philosophers and scientists, such as there were. Was that the scientists were the philosophers who went into the lab. End of story. There isn't much more difference than that. And that's why, you know, if you look at the way Popper talks about philosophy or science, he tends to blend the people in terms of his references and things. You know, if he's talking about a philosophical topic, he might be citing Peter Medawar or some scientist he knows as having philosophical views. He had no problem with this. What was interesting, and it came up in your remarks about the invisibility of revolutions in Popper. I think the way you kind of see this is that when you are doing all these experiments, these crucial experiments, Popper expects, and I think most scientists would expect, that most of the time your hypothesis is not falsified, right? Most of the time, they're confirmed, because you kind of already know what's going on, right? You should try to falsify them, but most of the time you'll get some kind of confirmation. Popper's point is, don't get too excited by that, right? In a sense, you haven't really done any real science until you get to the point where you're falsified. Then you're in this kind of, you know, mode of having to rethink everything, the kairotic moment of falsification, right? But most of the time, you do the experiments, and you're just confirmed, right? So in a sense, the revolutions in that sense, you know, aren't deliberately, they're not staged in some very, you know, kind of planned way. It's something that happens, you know, as a consequence of something where you're trying to push the limits of what you think you know. So, but yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid that we have to stop here in order to go further and to give floor to the next speaker. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you, everybody.